Your dad was John McCain.
Yes. My dad was a huge music fan. I'm going to tell you right now, my dad loved Willie Nelson. And people are like, you can't say you liked Willie Nelson because he dodged his taxes, blah, blah, blah. Well, he loved Willie Nelson. He did.
Everybody thinks they can do it. How can I become a professional wrestler? You really can't.
I pulled out the gun and I shot two times.
We have a complicated family. We were all raised to argue with each other with intensity, with passion, but also to love each other.
This is WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome to WTMJ Conversations. I'm your host, Libby Collins. The Wauwatosa Historical Society is having an exhibit of historical artifacts that documents a company that dates back to 1875. And joining us today is landscape architect Joe Kressel. He is the owner of Hawks, which has survived two world wars, the Great Depression, the Cold War, 9/11, the start of the digital age, and so much more. And I find this fascinating, Joe, that a business has survived everything that's happened the last 150 years.
I know there's not too many of us, and I'm really proud to be the steward of Hawks Nursery for all these years that I've been involved.
Well, I want to talk to you a little bit about the landscape of the area that surrounds Wauwatosa, where Hawks was, and Elm Grove, and all of the areas around there. Let's go back to 1875. What was the landscape like?
Well, in 1875, Hawks was actually originated in Rochester, New York. And shortly after its inception, Theodore Ferguson, who was a resident of Wauwatosa, started up a branch. And the first property that they farmed was at in Wauwatosa between Wisconsin and Blue Mound at about 59th Street. And they rented 20 acres there. And they found that the soil in this area was very good for cultivation and for digging plant material, and the weather and the climate was ideal and became their primary growing area.
For the country?
For a whole country, right. Primarily northeastern United States. By the late 1800s, we had over 400 salespeople that worked for Hawks Nursery, and they worked in different railroad stations. The salespeople would largely be postmasters, and plant material then was shipped in the spring and fall, bare root, and crates packed with sphagnum moss. And being close to a railroad station was important, so that's why, you know, Wauwatosa was convenient, because we had a railroad going right through Wauwatosa.
What was the area like at that point? Obviously, Milwaukee was a city, but wasn't there a lot of farmland?
It was
in
all farmland, yeah. It was, you know, it wasn't really developed. There was some platting that was going on, but there was a 20-acre parcel. And shortly after that, we bought our first property on the corner of 91st and North Avenue. And there was 40 acres there. So that was our primary largest piece of property that we had that was all contiguous. And now, as you know, it's all developed. There's a school on the property and everything. But, you know, if you go into the backyard, oftentimes you can see that there's a lot of trees that are planted in rows in some of the homes. And it's kind of a curious little thing. And I don't think too many people know that all these trees were once growing in the fields.
That's what I was wondering, because it is a very interesting area in terms of having old trees and old landscape as you go into that part of Wauwatosa. Were those there originally? Do they predate 1875? Or were they things that were planted after the fact?
Well, I don't know exactly, but it's my assumption that from looking at old photos that it was all farmland. And, you know, the plant material was planted in rows and cultivated. And the industry was very similar to what it is today, but a little bit different. There wasn't quite as much plant material that was grown in containers. Very little was grown in containers. Most of the plant material was dug and bare rooted, but there was some plant material that was B&B, the bald and burlap, and that was also grown there. But, you know, they wouldn't let plant material get really, really huge, because then it was taking up too much real estate. So the goal in nursery business is to turn over your crops and allow the plant material to, once it reaches a saleable size, move it and sell it.
What were homes like then in terms of the landscape surrounding it? I mean, today you see perfect homes in suburbs with perfect landscape all planned out. But back then, wasn't it a more natural feel?
It's very similar to today in some respects, but I don't think as many people really focused in on design and putting plant material together. You know, it was the lilac planted off the corner of the home and maybe a vine growing up the side of the house. There was certainly shade trees were used quite extensively. And so I have a book that was written by the sales manager of Hogg's Nursery.
And this would be in what year?
It was right around World War I. And he would talk to the salespeople or tell the salespeople how to design a landscape. And he had like 3 or 4 designs and options of plant material. So back in the early 1900s, there was quite a bit of design going on.
What did those designs look like in that book you're talking about?
They're all pencil drawn. You know, today we use computers, but they were all hand drawn and they were very rough, kind of almost sketches in some respects. They were nicely laid out. We still, every now and then, especially from people in the Washington Highlands, we get customers that will give us old plans that were drawn in the late 1800s or early 1900s that they still have. So we've got some of those still in possession.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
Buckthorn was introduced as an ornamental plant originally, and it was cultivated.
Well, buckthorn has become the bane of existence for people in that area.
Yeah.
Landscape architect Joe Kressel talks about the evolution of gardens in Wisconsin.
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome back. I'm Libby Collins. We're talking with landscape architect Joe Kressel. Well, styles change. I mean, clothing styles change,
right.
Home styles. What were gardening styles like in the 19th century?
Well, you had the rock gardens and you had hedges, a lot of hedges. You know, people would plant hedges for privacy and...
What did they use for the hedge?
Privet.
Same as what you do today,
yeah,
then.
Yeah, privet and bridal's wreath and lilacs and honeysuckle, you know, kind of the same things, palettes that we have today to work with. And they didn't worry about invasive plants as much as we do today. And
why is that?
Well, they weren't aware of what plant material actually did. You know, nowadays we don't plant very many honeysuckles because they're so invasive and go invade the woodlands and they have dominance over it. And same thing with buckthorn. Buckthorn was introduced as an ornamental plant originally, and it was cultivated into columnar buckthorn. And when I was a young landscape architect, I used to use columnar buckthorn quite a bit, actually.
Well, buckthorn has become the bane of existence for people in that area.
Yeah, and the columnar buckthorn was supposedly, and it was great for making hedges along driveways between properties and things like that. And it was supposed to be not invasive or not producing fruit, but it did. And so there's a lot of plant material that we just don't use anymore.
So why does that change? I mean, what happens where people say, uh-oh, no more honeysuckle, more buckthorn.
Yeah.
We don't want those. If anything, we're going to yank them out of our yard.
Well, I think the industry kind of patrols itself. You know, where everybody in our industry has got into the industry because we love nature, and nature's a big factor in all of our lives. And so not wanting to harm woodlands and our forests and kind of protect, you know, Mother Nature as much as we can.
So when you talk about an invasive species, is that something that will kill off the plants surrounding it, or does it just overtake
it? It overpowers,
them?
Yeah. It has, you know, like buckthorn, for example. It has dominance over all other deciduous plants because it leafs out earlier and it loses its leaves later. So it has a much longer growing season because it tolerates bad weather and deer don't like it. And they won't eat buckthorn. I wish we could get deer to eat buckthorn and not my hydrangeas and dogwood and all the plants that I want to keep.
I was just thinking that myself. Is there a way to get rid of something like buckthorn?
It's very difficult. You got to dig it out by the roots and then it'll come back. And so it's a constant battle. And it's one that I do on my own property. And I dig out the plants, reseed it, and young little ones come in. I do spray it to keep them from growing, but it's a never-ending battle.
You mentioned spray. And I'm thinking back to 1875, the early 1900s. How did people control weeds and things like that at that time.
It was all mechanical by hand. And interestingly enough, in other countries like Canada, they have outlawed chemicals. And some of the most beautiful gardens in the world are found in Canada around Niagara Falls and Victoria Falls, Bouchard Gardens. And all the weeds are pulled by hand using organic remedies, you know, like vinegar.
Does that work?
Not well, but it works. There's a vinegar that's really concentrated, that's 40% vinegar, and that works pretty well. And you can get it, I think, at Home Depot or stores like that.
Oh, so you have to get like a commercial vinegar.
If there's a commercial cleaning vinegar that actually is specifically distilled for killing weeds.
I want to go back to what homes looked like back 100 years ago. In terms of landscape, you mentioned things like lilacs, and I would imagine roses were very popular and honeysuckle. But was the idea to enhance a home and the property around it, or was it to just have it because people liked it?
Yeah, I think it was for beautification, to make your property a little bit more beautiful. Another interesting tidbit, if you go into the woods or if you're looking at old home sites or old foundations, oftentimes you'll see plants like lilacs, which don't go into the wild naturally very easily. And that's probably the site of an old homestead where people would plant the lilac, for example. So that's kind of a fun little tidbit.
You mentioned how rich the soil is in this area. Mm-hmm. A lot of people also say it's very clay-like. What's the difference and what do you want in your soil?
Well, you want a loamy soil, certainly.
What does loamy mean?
Loamy is not as tight as clay. It's not as hard as clay. So we do have a high clay content, and why they always talked about this being the perfect soil, I'm not quite sure, because it is a tough soil to dig in and everything. But it also, for a B&B plant, you wouldn't want a real sandy soil because the ball of dirt would all fall apart. A clay soil will hold it together. There are advantages
to having that.
I think so, yeah. And I think what was most notable or important about it is that we were close to the railroad tracks, and, you know, plant material then would go on horse-drawn wagons and go down to the railroad tracks, and then it would be shipped off to, you know, all over the country.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
You know, you younger guys, you like to get on your horse and go from farm to farm, and it's much better if you walk.
Joe Kressel talks about a letter he found in the Hawks artifacts that describes a salesman's frustration with newfangled transportation.
You're listening to WTMJ Conversations.
I'm your host, Libby Collins. Let's return to our conversation with landscape architect Joe Kressel. Well, this exhibit at the Wauwatosa Historical Society, you've got a lot of pictures that are going to be involved. What were some of the things that you found when you were researching the area and researching the history of your company that stood out to you as being very indicative of what life was like then?
What surprises me the most is how little has changed in the industry in 150 years. I have one salesperson that worked for the company in 1894, and he was a sales rep for Walworth County. And he would write back to the home office every Monday, and he called it his Monday morning letter to the great Hawks Nursery Company. And he would then talk about what it was like being a salesperson and walking from farm to farm and going and selling his wares. And he would then talk, you know, you younger guys, you like to get on your horse and go from farm to farm. And it's much better if you walk, because at the end of the evening, they'll always give you a nice warm place to stay in the barn, you know, sleeping on some soft hay. And in the morning at the breakfast table is a place to sign a contract. And so, you know,
it was a
different lifestyle. But then he would talk about the weather and how weather affected the sales and how the rain and the spring and the snow and everything, that all the environmental factors that are harmful to plant material. He would talk about these, and it's the same challenges we have today, and complain that customers don't water their plant material and then they die, you know, and we have the same thing. If people don't water their plants, you know, they die. And so it's kind of, some things just haven't changed.
It is interesting, though, how you say that this one particular salesperson would walk. I bet he learned a lot about the property by doing that versus being on a horse or a carriage or whatever and quickly getting through the territory.
Yeah, I would think so too. You know, it must have been fascinating time to live where you head out on a Monday morning by foot and then you go visit all your customers and walk back at the end of the week, I assume. I don't know. But a completely different lifestyle.
You mention you've got paperwork going back almost 150 years in some of these cases. What did trees cost then?
Oh, it was like a dollar or a dollar and a quarter for a tree. You know, there was...
Was that like an oak or was it...
We have one sales record selling to the Eline family and it was like, oh, you know, this huge sale and it made the minutes of the corporate books and the corporate books that we made this huge sale of selling trees for $100. We sold $100 worth of trees and, you know, that was a big deal. And that was probably 100 trees.
You said the Uline family.
Uline, yeah.
What are some of the other places in the area that you have records going back that you know what the things cost and what was planted at the time?
I have price books going back many years.
Do you have locations of where things were planted?
Well, in some of the plans that we have, you know, we did the original landscaping for Brookfield Mall and Southridge Mall and Bayshore Mall, but that was all like in the 50s.
Yeah, that was just the other day.
Yeah.
I'm talking that, way back.
You know, a lot of homes that we have plans of, quite honestly, in the early years, we weren't so much a landscape construction company as a retail sales company. And so we would sell more plant material. That was the main focus. And we didn't really become more of a local regional company until after the Depression. And that's when things kind of changed. In 1926, we had a gentleman, and I actually met him, and he was a graduate of Harvard Agricultural School, and he claimed to be a landscape architect. And he actually worked for Hawks Nursery, and he claimed to be the first landscape architect to actually work for a landscape nursery and do landscaping. So in the 1800s, I don't think we did a whole lot of landscaping. We primarily just sold plant material. And it wasn't until, you know, around the time of the Depression that we became more of a landscape salesperson. And then apparently, according to his book that he gave me, we laid him off in the middle of the Depression because we didn't have enough work for him.
And he still spoke to you.
He still spoke to me. But he was very proud of the fact. And, you know, after we moved to our current location on Watertown Plank Road in 1928, and we sold the property on 91st and North Avenue, and we've moved a little bit farther west, right near Elm Grove. And that location was originally 38 acres, and it went right to the railroad tracks, and it was much more convenient shipping out of that location. And he lived two doors down, and his home still stands today where he was living.
That's fascinating.
Right on the southeast corner of 124th and Watertown Plank Road was his home.
So we'll know next time we drive by.
It's a picture of it in his book.
Still ahead on WTMJ Conversations.
Design has really improved over the years and has gotten more and more elaborate as we go on and more refined.
Landscape architect Joe Kressel describes the urban planning process around Milwaukee in the early part of the 20th century.
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
I'm your host, Libby Collins. Let's return to our conversation with landscape architect and the owner of Hawks, Joe Kressel. What about towns and cities at that time and villages? We had a lot of villages, mm-hmm. obviously, in southeastern Wisconsin. Was there a concerted effort for urban planning as far as what the town fathers wanted in areas where there would be outdoor areas, parkways and parks and things like that?
Sure. You know, a lot changed with Frederick Law Olmsted. You know, he changed a lot in terms of the way the public's acceptance of what was good. And he helped design, you know, he did a park along Lake Michigan. He designed that and certainly Central Park in New York and a lot of other famous things. But he started a whole trend into more of a design and getting more involved in designing. And it just grew. But there were two separate professions. There were landscape architects and then there were nurseries. and then maybe a third actually construction companies. And, you know, we start out as a nursery. So design has really improved over the years and has gotten more and more elaborate as we go on and more refined. But I almost, in some respects...
How can you be refined and elaborate?
Well, you know, the things that we add nowadays, you know, fire pits and outdoor kitchens and, you know, all those other... you know, fancy amenities and arbors and gazebos. And, you know, and certainly there were, you know, fire pits and things going way back. But the inclusion of them nowadays is much more intense as, than it was years ago. But in some respects, I almost like what we did, you know, 100 years ago. And because it was a bigger... nature was a bigger factor, and having a natural look was you know really important back then. So there's a lot of
what were those elements?
Well, prairies certainly, prairies and fields, and you know the restoration of prairies is a wonderful thing. But you know they're not very conducive in an urban setting. But prairies and open spaces and lakes and ponds and creating natural environments that that would surround a home. You know, if there's, I had the opportunity to go to Lakewood Gardens about a month ago in Philadelphia, just outside of Philadelphia, and it's one of the most attractive gardens that I've ever seen in my life. And there's all these gardens, these you know very formal gardens. Are surrounded by woods and lakes and beautiful, beautiful nature, and it really enhances it enhances a garden to have that look. And at my own home, I'm really proud of that. My home, the front yard is all woods, and the backyard is kind of an open space and more of and it's nice to have a little bit of both worlds.
How has, and I guess we touched on this, that architecture, landscape architecture has changed in the last 150 years. Mm-hmm. In your opinion, or at least in your study of history, when was that moment where it went from a very natural kind of look to things being much more... It's got to be, and I don't want to use the word cookie cutter, but if you look, a lot of homes have similar landscaping.
I think things changed after World War II, and they got things got a lot more cookie cutter, as you might say, and nature kind of left, and it was well, we can control nature, and then. When I was in college in the early 70s, it kind of changed. There was a big theme of historic preservation and prairies and woodlands and we learned more about native plant material than we did about ornamental plant material, and it's important that we. Keep those native plants alive and growing in our landscapes. And I think that is kind of becoming a part of all of our landscapes is getting nature and natural plant material as a part of it.
If you're fortunate enough to have mm-hmm. property where you can have that sort of natural landscape, how do you let it be natural, but at the same time, be healthy and in control.
Well, you know, people think that, you know, having a natural landscape is easy and you don't have to, you just let it go. But that's not the case. It's actually a natural landscape is almost more work than having, because of the invasives. It's kind of controlling the invasives that come in and I think that's the greatest misnomer is that a natural landscape is easy. It isn't. If you want to have a true natural landscape, you gotta It's a constant battle keeping the buckthorns and the honeysuckle and the garlic mustard.
But isn't that natural to have those?
No,
I'm being facetious.
I think those plants are from Asia and not from, you know, from our continent.
Not from Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
The zoo has beautiful walks through and you get to see animals at the same time.
Landscape architect Joe Kressel talks about his favorite gardens around southeastern Wisconsin.
You're listening to WTMJ Conversations.
And I'm Libby Collins. Our guest today is landscape architect Joe Kressel. As you look around this area, what are some of your favorite outdoor spaces?
There's a lot of great gardens in Wisconsin, and unfortunately, most of them are in private residence, and they're not the public gardens that there once were. You know, the attention or government has not made that a high priority to have as many spaces. I think when I first moved to Milwaukee, there was flowers in all the boulevards and everything. And we've kind of gotten away from that. But there's a lot of wonderful private residences in Wisconsin that are just absolutely gorgeous that have phenomenal gardens.
I'm going to throw you a curveball here. What do you think about the domes?
They're going through an interesting stage. They're going through an interesting stage, and I'm wishing them all the luck in the world. That I love the domes, and I wish that they are able to raise the money necessary to do their plan. They've got a good plan in place to elaborate and change kind of the work that they're doing and expand. I think they have an education element that they're trying to add, and hopefully they're able to raise the money that they need. Because I think it's an important historic part of Milwaukee. And, you know, they're kind of a unique building. I've never seen buildings like that before. And I think it's very important that we save those.
And why is it important to have public areas where people can enjoy the beauty of nature? Well, especially when you're close to a city.
You know, it's funny when you're in an urban area, how few people have the opportunity to really get out. I'm involved with an organization. It's called Nehemiah, and we take care of young boys and that are wards of the court for one reason or another. And in this group home, we'll go on field trips. Some of them have never seen Lake Michigan. And we're located on 27th and Valit. And, you know, and they go, I didn't know this was here. And, you know, and some of our inner city kids are really, you know, disadvantaged in not having the opportunity to experience nature and to really know what it's all about. And, you know, and even having Christmas trees. I donate a Christmas tree every year. And they don't even... Some of them never had a live Christmas tree or never saw a live Christmas tree. It's kind of sad. And so I think it's important that we have these parks and things available to people. Another great garden really is also the zoo, the Milwaukee County Zoo, which is it's a wonderful walk through the zoo. I've been involved with them for almost 30 years, and the zoo has beautiful walks through, and you get to see animals at the same time, so that's a great walk.
What are some of the high points in the zoo, in from your perspective, not of the animals, but of the landscape architecture?
It's really unique. Our zoo, our Milwaukee County Zoo, is unique from any other zoo in the Midwest or almost any zoo in the area, because we have this big natural woodland area that we're at with a huge lake, Lake Evinrude. And it's just really, really nice to have that as open for, you know, everybody to enjoy. And if you go to, you know, the Cincinnati Zoo, which is really a good zoo, and St. Louis Zoo, they're more urban zoos. They don't have the wild, you know, woods and, you know, and so it's kind of makes our zoo a little bit special.
As you look at this area, are there things that you think should be different or that the planners should be looking at, not for today, not for tomorrow, but for 100 years from now, 150 years from now? What will the landscape look like then?
Well, hopefully we reserve a lot of land for preservation.
Do you see that happening, though, in most of the areas?
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of the cities and communities are pretty, you know, the zoning, they're having pretty good zoning regulations, and they're keeping, you know, a good amount of open space available. And there's a lot of good organizations out there, you know, like Nature Conservancy, and that are out there reserving and preserving land for the future. And I think that those organizations are doing a great job and getting that. So I think we're on a good path.
Does that concern you that we're expanding too much into some of these beautiful areas, you know, around Wisconsin?
Yeah, it's yes and no. You know, it's part of progress. And as we grow as a country, you know, and more people, you know, everybody needs to have a place to live and everything. So I don't know. I've got mixed feelings.
Well, you want to have a place to live, but you also want to have the beauty of nature around you.
Right. Correct.
So there's a real challenge in incorporating both.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's a challenge. You know, hopefully we can keep on preserving land and moving in the right direction. Look at what was done with Central Park in New York. What would New York be without Central Park, without that beautiful parkland? Now, in this community, we've tried to ring our parks around so that interconnect them with bike trails and things like that, and connect all the parkland. And I'm working on another beer line trail that's in the inner city that we're working on right now in terms of designing and making that a connector through some of more of the depressed areas of the city so that people can explore by bicycles and, you know, get around and see more of the city.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
If you are beyond the railroad tracks, on the other side of the pond, you can see there's painted on the side of the building the offices of the Hawks Nursery Company.
Joe Kressel describes the new Hawks exhibit at the Wauwatosa Historical Society.
Now more of WTMJ Conversations.
I'm Libby Collins. Today's conversation is with Joe Kressel. He's a landscape architect and the owner of Hawks. The Wauwatosa Historical Society is going to be exhibiting much of your memorabilia as you get close to November, and I believe you're also going to be speaking. What sort of things will you have there?
Well, we're putting together a little vignette. It's an old drafting table from the 1800s. And some of the drafting tools that were, you know, that were used at that point in time. I've got an old typewriter as well. And with that typewriter is a picture that was taken in the late 1800s or early 1900s. It's hard for me to tell exactly. With that typewriter in it and with women typing with long dresses, you know, that reached the floor. And this was actually in one of our first offices. We had a whole series of offices throughout Wisconsin, but this one was in the Hemsley Building in Wauwatosa. And right now it's Cafe Benelux. It was Chancery before that. And before that was an Zimmerman Architecture. And we were on the second floor of the Hemsley Building. And if you look at old pictures, our name is on the window. And so the walls are kind of, you know, kittywampus in that building, and because there's some angles, some strange angles. And these strange angles are in those photographs. And if you are beyond the railroad tracks, on the other side of the pond, you can see there's painted on the side of the building. It's the offices of the Hawks Nursery Company are still painted on the side of the building. Very few people see that, but it's kind of interesting. That's going to be there. And I have an old sign from the early 50s. I've got a uniform from the 40s.
A uniform?
The uniform that a crew member would wear, you know, with it, it's all hand sewn, and it's kind of fun and different. I also have ice tongs, and you probably wonder, what are the ice tongs for? And the ice tongs are, they would, when we would ship plant material in these wooden crates, we would fill them with sphagnum moss, and then we'd also put ice in it. And the ice would melt over a period of time. And it would keep the plant material. It was like a slow release watering to water the plant material as they're being shipped by rail to whatever community they would go to.
That's fascinating. Yeah.
And then some old pictures, and it'll be fun.
And you will be talking about the history.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, looking forward to that.
Well, we're looking forward to hearing it. Joe Kressel from Hawks Nursery, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
We've been talking with landscape architect Joe Kressel. He talked about the history of Hawks Nursery, how it began 150 years ago, and how things have changed and what stayed the same in that business that's been in the area for so long and is now the object of an exhibit at the Wauwatosa Historical Society. Now, if you joined us late and you want to hear our entire conversation with Joe, go to WTMJ.com and share today's show with your friends and family. You'll also find a partial transcript courtesy of eCourt Reporters. For WTMJ Conversations, I'm Libby Collins.